just numbed out on reality TV. So every time.
You are listening to KWR 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. High-speed internet services for KWR underwritten by Horizon Cable, cablecasting KWMR on television channel 47 in Point Reyes Station, Olema, Inverness Park, Inverness and Dillon Beach, online at horizoncable.com. KWR is supported by Osmosis Day Spa Sanctuary, offering massages, organic facials, and the Japanese cedar enzyme bath. Osmosis is located near the Sonoma Coast, just up Highway 1, and features 5 acres of gardens, as well as local and organic meals. The spa menu, online booking, and info about the surrounding area can be found at osmosis.com.
La 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 la. All the Bible says for certain that you are in fact a man, and I'd say you've got great taste for a guy. You've made mountains and rivers and the luscious scent of roses, and I just love what you've done with the sky. However, it appears you've too much time on your hands, for you're creating many things that we don't need, like pestilence and warfare and a lot of bad diseases and a whole bunch of people we can't feed. I've been trying to call you almost daily. Do not make me come to your home. I am serious, believe me. If you want to relieve me, then put Mrs. God on the phone. Put Mrs. God.
This is this week's edition of Hot Tech Cool Science. If you hold on, we'll get started in just a moment.
Toast without any butter. Drank my coffee with sugar and cream and chased my liquor with water. I'll go out behind the old red barn and let a gray mule kick my brains out. When I get sissy enough to wash the dishes for my wife and hang out diapers and make up beds, you'll know I'm ruined for life. When I get sissy enough to take that dumb bath each day, I'll go out behind the old red barn and let a gray mule kick my brains out. When I get sissy enough to wear a mustache and a bow tie and wear those pretty suede shoes that a lot of those sissies buy.
Hello again, it's Julie Motz. The program is Hot Tech Cool Science. Today we're going to be talking about two very interesting conferences of very related but different kinds. One is happening just next week and one is happening in July. And the one in July is the IONS Conference. It's sponsored by the Institute of Noetic Sciences. It's their 18th international conference. It's happening in Santa Clara, July 18th through the 21st. It's called the Possibility Accelerator, Creating Our Future Now. We're going to talk about that more in detail, but we have two really extraordinary scientists from the Institute with us, and the first is Dean Radin. He's the chief scientist at IONS. And Dean, I think I first ran into you at an ICEM conference many, many years ago in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, yes.
Back in the very early days of studying energy medicine and subtle energy. And you have just, you know, persisted and pursued this. But you have a background in more traditional science before that. You worked at AT&T Bell Labs and at Princeton and SRI. And what were you doing there before you came to IONS?
Well, in all of the places you just mentioned, part of it was conventional research, like at Bell Labs, I was involved in telecommunications research. At Princeton, I was the coordinator of a multidisciplinary program on human information processing, which was a consortium among departments in psychology and computer science and engineering and a few other of the departments. At SRI, I was working on the formerly classified government program on psychic espionage. So I always had at least one foot on noetic topics and one foot on more traditional topics.
Yeah. And noetic being the use of science to study what goes on inside the mind, or is there a more, is there a better definition?
Well, noetic itself is a word that basically means intuition, but a type of intuition where you get information without knowing how you're getting it and with certainty that it's correct. And more often than not, the intuitive intuition that you get or the this noetic sense, in fact, is correct. So, yes, it's the application of science to those kinds of experiences.
And was it your personal experiences in that realm that led you to this interest, or did you read about it or hear of friends having these experiences?
I read too much science fiction when I was a kid. So, I mean, in the more modern generation, it would be a child who read all of the Harry Potter series and just became fascinated with the idea of whether it's even possible for things like magic to exist. So I just never forgot that.
Mm-hmm. And you went on to investigate where magic might exist.
Right.
So I just looked up a couple of your papers. Effects of intentionally treated water on growth of Arabidopsis.
Arabidopsis, yes.
Thaliana seeds with cryptochrome mutations. Cryptochrome, I assume, has to do with color.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where the origin of that term came from, but that was a study where many of my studies have looked at the role of intention in the mm-hmm. physical world. Mm-hmm. Like, does your intention do something outside your body directly?
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, we had three senior Buddhist monks from a temple in Taiwan, and I worked with a colleague in Taiwan, to bless water, which would then be used to hydrate these seeds.
Mm-hmm.
The Arabidopsis plant is like a little mustard plant, and it's used a lot in plant research because the genome was fully sequenced before the human genome. So a lot is known about the way that the genetics of that plant go. In addition, it has a protein in it called cryptochrome, which is thought to have quantum properties.
What are quantum properties? I'm only familiar with the term in physics as in a quantum leap of an electron.
Ah, okay. So it means that one of the mysteries in cases of birds who navigate over thousands of miles is how do they know how to get from here to there? Especially, they only take the trip maybe once in their lifetime or once a year. Well, how do they go back exactly to the same spot where they were born? Well, so there are a variety of different ways that could happen, but one of the ways that is suspected is that they can sense or even see the Earth's magnetic field lines. So in order to do that, they need to be exquisitely sensitive to magnetic fields. Well, from a quantum perspective, which is talking about the microscopic world of elementary particles, you can build systems that are incredibly sensitive to magnetic fields. As it turns out, this particular protein, which is in the eye of birds, also turns out to be in humans and plants and every other living thing, it's very, very, very sensitive to magnetic fields. So it happens to be in this little plant that we studied as well, in fact, in every plant. And so we thought, well, maybe the mind can influence things at the quantum scale, at this elementary particle scale, more easily than it could if we were trying to simply shove something around the size of a brick.
Mm-hmm.
So we had this blessed water. We had an equal amount of non-blessed water as a control. And then under double-blind conditions, the plants were grown with the blessed water or the non-blessed water to see if it made any difference. And the blessing that was put into the water was that any plant grown with this water would grow better,
mm-hmm.
would be more healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So the measure we used is something called a hypocotyl, which is the stem of a plant between the top of the seed and the bottom of the first leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's a short, fat, little stem, it's a healthy plant. And if it's a long, skinny stem, then it means that the plant was struggling probably to try to pop up to get more light or something like that, but it's not very healthy. So we use that as our primary measure, and indeed we ended up running 12 repetitions of this experiment, and overall found very strong evidence that the blessed water simply made the seeds grow better, even under conditions where the person who was involved in the growing of the plant and the measuring of the stem knew nothing about the nature of the water that was being used. It was just A and B, unbeknownst to that person. A and B were actually, one was blessed and one wasn't, and it made a difference.
Well, I do remember years ago reading The Secret Life of Plants, which presented many cases, and I don't know what the evidence was behind them. I remember music being played, and if it was rock and roll, the plants grew away from it. If it was classical music in a greenhouse, they grew towards it. I remember that struck me very forcefully.
Yeah, and a lot has been learned since then, since that book, about the communication between plants. So in the case of responding to Mozart, say, and not responding to Rammstein, those typically are not done under double-blind conditions.
Uh-huh. Well, obviously,
so,
yes.
Yeah, so it's difficult to extract the experimenter from what is happening in the experiment. And that actually turns out to be difficult in most cases. But at least when we're testing two different kinds of substances or two treatments, we can use double-blind methods with people.
Yeah, and then precognition as a form of prospection, a review of the evidence. I mean, this reminds me of the remote viewing. Well, not the remote viewing, because that's not actually the same thing, because they're not predicting the future. But this suggests that communication from the future is actually happening.
Right. So actually, it is related to remote viewing, in that many remote viewing trials are all about perception through space or time.
I was only familiar with those through space.
Yeah.
Oh no! I remember when they were using it to predict the outcome of the silver futures market.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it's the same phenomenon. It's clairvoyance in one form or another, but it's about perceiving through space or time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you found evidence that this does happen. That's what I take it. I didn't read the whole paper.
Yeah. So that was for a special journal article on prospection, which in conventional psychology is all about anticipation of future events. Mm-hmm. So we wrote a paper saying, well, there's actually quite a bit of evidence saying that we can directly get information about the future, even when you have no way to anticipate under normal ways.
And is there any way someone can enhance their ability to receive this information?
Well, my standard answer is yes, but it's probably through meditation, because it's the slowest, most gentle, but also most effective method. Mm-hmm. So the alternative, say, is that we're working on a project that could ultimately someday maybe be turned into a pill that you would take and you'd become super psychic. The problem with that is that if you're not ready for something like that, it would be much worse than taking a psychedelic. You're thrust into a way of perceiving the world that would be shocking for most people and probably dangerous. Mm-hmm. So that's why I recommend that meditation is the best way.
Well, your work is fascinating, and I could easily devote a whole program to it. In fact, I'm thinking I probably shall in the future. But I want to talk briefly about the conference that's coming up, July 18th through 21st.
Mm-hmm.
I know Rupert Sheldrake is speaking about a couple of... What are the... And this is like asking one to choose among favorite children. What are the parts of the conference that you find the most interesting and exciting, where actually someone as advanced and sophisticated as you might learn something?
Actually, I always like the question and answer period after a talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because it, among other things, it always allows you to judge, first of all, are people paying attention?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is usually yes. And second, how sophisticated are they?
Mm-hmm.
So the audiences that come to this conference tend to be pretty sophisticated about these topics.
Mm-hmm.
So the questions that they ask and what I hope to hear is something I have not been asked before.
Mm-hmm.
And because then it teaches me something as well as gives the audience something of interest as well.
And what are you going to be speaking about or presenting?
I'm going to, well, the title of my talk... What is the title of my talk? The Science and Future of Ancient Wisdom. And the whole point of it is that if you ask somebody who's a conventional physicist today, well, what do you think about ESP? They'll probably say, well, we don't know of any physical laws that would allow for that, so probably doesn't exist. That kind of response makes sense if, first of all, if you don't know anything about the evidence,
mm-hmm.
you would simply guess from a theoretical basis that it's impossible. The problem is that there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, it is possible.
I'd say it's probably more accurate to say we don't know any laws that preclude that.
Well, that is now true, and that's part of what I'm talking about. So if somebody says ESP is impossible because it violates the laws of physics, they're talking about what Newton was doing back in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
But today's physics allow for all kinds of strange interconnections through space and time, which start to look more and more similar to these kinds of experiences that people talk about. So my talk is going to be saying, well, let's simply look at what happened over the course of the 20th century. We don't even need to go back to Newton. Just over the 20th century, how did our understanding of reality change?
Mm-hmm.
And is that more compatible with experiences that people describe as psychic? And the short answer is yes, mm-hmm. and I'll explain why.
And for listeners who want to attend this conference, it's happening July 18th and 21st in Santa Clara. KWR will have a discount, special discount for our listeners. It's KWMR, just the call letters of the station. And if you go to noetic.org/conference, you'll be able to register and get a $50 discount for being a KWR listener. So of this vast field, Dean, what fascinates you most at the moment? I know you probably have a lot of experiments going at the same time,
mm-hmm.
but you've been in this for a very, very long time. So what are the mysteries that still compel you or compel you the most?
Well, from a theoretical perspective, we still are struggling to understand how is it possible for somebody to gain information from a distance through space and time. We don't know how that happens. So I don't think we're going to solve it next Tuesday either. So that's going to be around for a while.
Well, is the idea that this reception of information happens faster than the speed of light, is that the problem?
Well, that's one of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the other problem is with any kind of clairvoyance, well, how can you pick up what's happening on the other side of the world?
Mm-hmm.
We know it's not electromagnetic,
mm-hmm.
because that's been tested. So, well, what is the only other thing we can think of at this point is something like quantum entanglement. But that doesn't work very well either, at least what we know today about quantum entanglement that is not very compatible with this thing. So it suggests that that psychic phenomena in general are still ahead of where science is. And eventually science will catch up, but it's very difficult to tell at this point whether we will catch up next week or 10 years from now or a century from now. But when we do, I have a certain faith that eventually science will be clever enough to figure it out. We will have a radically different sense of the nature of reality than we have today.
Well, I remember years ago when I was talking to Russell Targ about remote viewing, he said that it seemed to work best with locations where they were associated with intense emotions,
mm-hmm.
where people had an intense emotional experience or response to that. So in our emotions, which people usually experience as energy, do you think there might be some clue to this magical communication?
My guess is that the reason why what I might call numinous locations or meaningful locations are important is because of the psychological side
mm-hmm.
of these phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a form of connection between the psyche and physics,
mm-hmm.
between mind and matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't just look at the physics of this and say, how does that work? Because it's modulated by the psyche and vice versa. So this is one of the reasons it's so difficult, because the psychological world is extremely messy from
mm-hmm.
a scientific perspective. And the physical world, well, we have a pretty good idea about what's going on there, but we certainly haven't wrapped it all up yet. So when you take two elements which are both very complicated, and now we're talking about the way that they interconnect, you can see the problem that we face. And for me personally, then, this is a great challenge, which is why I find it perpetually interesting.
Well, if you want to hear Dean Radin's best guess as to the near future and maybe the distant future of this whole area, you can attend the Institute of Noetic Sciences 18th International Conference, July 18th to 21st. It's noetic.org/conference, and use KWMR for a discount code. Dee, thank you so much for the work that you do and for coming on Hot Tech Cool Science to talk to us about it. It's been great to reconnect with you.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a musical break and bring on our next guest.
I've examined all the scriptures with their tenets and their strictures, and I wonder who died and made you boss. For with your twisted sense of management, it's hard to contain the damage when you nail your best employees to a cross.
She must be right up to her eyeballs, trying to maintain some order at home. And there are no friends with which to hobnob when you're married to a whack job. So come on, put Mrs. God on the phone.
Hello again, it's Julie Motz. The program is Hot Tech Cool Science. And now we have with us the president and senior scientist of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, Cassandra Vieden. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly.
Yes, that's right.
So Cassie is a psychologist, a mind-body medicine researcher, and she's focused primarily on spirituality and health, transformative experiences and practices, and the development of mindfulness-based interventions for emotional well-being. Her primary interest lies in how psychology, biology, and spirituality interact to affect experience and behavior. So what brought you to the Institute of Noetic Sciences? What made you feel that this was the best place to pursue your interests?
Well, I went to the California Institute of Integral Studies, which some of you might be familiar with, which is in San Francisco and is a combination of Western psychology, Eastern philosophy, and indigenous wisdom. So there we were taking classes in cognitive behavioral therapy and Freud and Jung and, you know, psychodynamics. At the same time, we were taking classes in Sanskrit and the Abhidharma. And that was a wonderful experience, and I fully intended to become a psychotherapist. But right at the end, I thought, you know, I'm not sure if helping one person at a time is going to change the world. And so I thought, you know, I really want to get into science. My dad is a scientist, and my mom is a therapist, so I think I had the science bug wake up inside me. And I went to the University of California, San Francisco, and trained in behavioral genetics for about 12 years while still pursuing my interest in spirituality and meditation and shamanism and other topics on my free time. And then by the end of that stint, I thought, you know, I really don't want to be in the completely conventional materialist world either. There must be some place that brings both together. I put science and spirituality into my browser and found the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which was about 5 minutes from my house, and I've been here ever since.
Uh-huh. And since you've been there, what research have you pursued?
Well, the first project I worked on here ended up being about a 10 to 15-year project, and that was on the process of transformation, how people have significant shifts in their worldview or their perception or their sense of self that change in profound and long-lasting ways, their behavior, their way of thinking, their patterns in the world. And, of course, the Institute was founded by Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who had a similar experience on his way back to the Earth after his moonwalk. And when he had the window seat in the space capsule, he had this epiphany that changed the way he saw everything forever. And many, many other people have had that experience, too, that have led them to lead more service-oriented, altruistic, and purpose-driven lives. So we were interested in what causes that kind of change and how we could foster it.
Is that an experience you've personally had, or coming from the household you did, were you always on that path?
I don't think I was always on that path. I had amazing parents, one very scientific and one into Jungian studies, so I think I was well prepared. But as a teenager, I had a lot of struggles with feeling emotionally highly sensitive and, you know, really struggling with anxiety, depression, and then finding drugs and finding that those experiences sometimes were profoundly transformative, but that the use of drugs was not really sustainable at a health and well-being level. So I did have these wild experiences and then found ways to pursue that in healthier and more better context-driven ways, like meditation practices and shamanism and some of the world's wisdom traditions. So, yes.
Yeah. In my own experience with drugs, my sense is that it doesn't deliver the complete, it doesn't automatically integrate the experience, but it lets you observe how you might be in a certain emotional state, and later, when you're off the drug, you can work to be that way. But my disappointment was that it wasn't an automatic integration.
Yeah, certainly the way I was doing it as a teenager was definitely not. And then, you know, I do think that psychedelic therapies with appropriate set and setting and preparation and integration practices can really work profoundly, have profound influences, positive influences on people's lives. And at our upcoming conference, at the IONS conference in July, we're going to be having a psychedelics and transformation panel with some of the folks from CIIS, my alma mater, who are now actually have a certificate program for people who are being trained to help people integrate those experiences. So I'm really gratified to see that.
Mm-hmm. And what else are you looking forward to? It's a huge conference with many fascinating things and wandering all over, not all over the map, all over this particular map. What are particularly you interested in hearing and learning about?
Oh, well, I mean, this is probably my 12th IONS conference or something along those lines. I've been here for quite a long time, and I'm probably more excited about this one than any of them in the past, just because we're at such an amazing point in our cultural and societal and global moment right now, where we've got significant threats to liberty and justice and, you know, significant backward movement in protection of the environment and women's rights and so many other things. And then at the very same time, we have this profoundly positive forward motion in innovation and awakening, and especially in young people, you know, deciding that we're going to live carbon neutral lives and deciding that we're going to find a solution to some of these issues. And so there's that tension point between the sort of naysayers who say we're past the point of no return, and then we've got these, you know, thousands of new solutions being created every single day. I choose to think that the solutions are going to win the day, and that this kind of a conference helps us blow on the coals of that kind of solution. Also, I think it's really important to bring in our intuitive, or what we call noetic, aspects of ourselves toward creating solutions for the future, because we can create all the technologies we want to try to help with the environment and solutions to things like prison reform and all of those things, but it requires a shift in consciousness on the part of individuals, policymakers, and society to make those things happen. And that shift in consciousness has to do with extending who we think we are to be more responsible and feel like we're connected with other people in ways that make it really difficult for us to harm others while benefiting ourselves.
We're going to take a music break, and then we'll return with Cassandra Vedan. And when we come back, I want to ask you particularly how noetic science, this study, how it can help with social justice issues and environmental issues, what the connection might be there. So we'll take a musical break, and then we'll come back and consider those questions.
I'm tired of all this sacrifice. These bloody battles just aren't nice. A woman would create a friendlier town. And with your tired little point of view of who begat and who slew, who just put Mrs. God on the phone? Who knows? She might have some really good ideas. Aren't you tired of hoisting the universe alone? I'm washed up as a believer, so just pass the receiver and put Mrs. God on the phone. Put Mrs. God on the phone.
You are listening to KWMR 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. Media support for KWMR is provided by the Point Reyes Light, family-owned since 1948, providing local news every Thursday in print and online, open Monday through Thursday in downtown Inverness, with information on classified subscriptions, advertising, and more at ptreyeslight.com or at 415-669-1200. We're going to return to our interview with Cassandra Vedan. She's the president and senior scientist of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And I asked her before to think about how noetic sciences, this whole field of study, applying science to the marvels of the mind and connectivity, can impact social justice and environmental issues.
Well, I mentioned earlier that we've been doing these studies on how people transform their consciousness and their worldview to more social justice-oriented, service-oriented, purpose-driven, and, you know, caring, altruistic, compassionate ways of life. And we did studies on that for quite a long time. And with what we've learned about the conditions that were present when people had such transformations, we sort of looked across all of their experiences and looked across multiple models of how people transform and boiled it down to what I call an ecosystem of change, which is what are the conditions we can provide for people that make it most likely that they'll have one of those experiences, or if you're trying to make change in an organization, in yourself, in society, if you have a campaign that you want to raise awareness about an issue or you want to make changes to policy, there are certain elements that you can put into place that come out of our research that make it more likely that that change will occur.
And what did you discover are those factors that make it possible for people to change?
Well, one of the most important ones is having direct experiences. So we can tell people all day long about the pollution in the oceans or, whatever information you're trying to convey, the inequity in imprisonment. But giving somebody some form of a personal experience, in-depth personal experience of that situation experientially makes it much more likely that they'll be able to see the discrepancy between how things are and how they could be or how they should be. So that could be, for example, taking somebody out in a boat to actually see the pollution in the ocean or having them talk to a group of prisoners or ex-convicts about their experiences and what would have helped to prevent recidivism. And, you know, those kinds of interactive things are very important. Another is giving people information and scientific evidence. So it's not enough, but it is important to give people the actual evidence. Giving them a community to connect with around the issue. So once we tell someone about, let's say, climate change or needing to reduce our footprint, we need to immediately give them tools and practices that they can apply in their everyday life, and then also a community of support, whether it's online or in person or both, and make sure that there's that kind of social scaffolding for what you're trying to get them to do, because in general, people do things because it's socially supported. Sometimes people are the only people in their community who feel or believe a certain way, and that means that you need to boost their sense of membership with a new community of people who are also living into the new way of being. So, for example, that's what we try to do at IONS, is provide all of these different elements to help people look at the world in a new way and live in a different way. And we were talking about the conference. That's one thing we try to do at the conference, is really connect people with community, give them scientific information, give them direct experiences, practices, and tools that they can take home with them. And that model really helps to make a change more than just telling someone the information.
Yeah, and I just wanted to mention again, the conference is happening July 18th through 21st. It's called the Possibility Accelerator, Creating Our Future Now, if you want to be part of that. KWMR listeners will get a discount of $50. The discount code is KWMR, and the place to register is noetic.org/conference. So you noticed, you mentioned an experience of these conditions, and I noticed, you know, reading up about you, that you're interested in virtual reality. We've done a number of shows about VR. So how have you seen VR, you know, opening up people to taking action and change?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is if you're a listener and you haven't tried VR yet, it can sound pretty abstract. It's important to say at the beginning that these experiences are quite compelling. They're very compelling illusions at a psychophysiological level. And so when I first did a major VR experience, it was called The Plank, where you walk out onto a plank and there's...
Oh, yes.
they drop the floor below you. And I mean, my entire body broke out in a cold sweat, and it took everything I had to even inch myself off the plank, even though every part of my mind knew that it was a flat floor underneath me. So, you know, that really turned me on to the idea that these kinds of illusions that we have in virtual reality could be used for multiple purposes to help shift people's worldviews. So right now, for example, there are some great projects at the United Nations where they are allowing children to go visit other children in villages around the world, whether they're virtual children or whether they're actually real children. So you might enter into somebody's village, sit down in a hut, see what they have for food, for a meal, see where they sleep, see where they go to the bathroom. And it really allows the kids to not just hear that other people live differently from you, but to experience it without ever having to leave their classroom. Another one that was interesting was showing kids in college, and they were trying to get them to think about saving for retirement. And what they did in virtual reality was they used a program to age their faces, and they had them meet themselves as older people in virtual reality, and that made it more likely that they would sign up for starting to save for retirement. And there's numerous other examples. Of course, at IONS, we're really interested in, number one, how to shift people's awareness to this more interconnected, interdependent worldview. And so we're working right now on a project to mimic Edgar Mitchell's experience in space. This is happening along with Lauren Carpenter, who's the co-founder of Pixar Animation Studios and won a couple of Academy Awards for inventing 3D landscape modeling, and also with the programmers in Ireland who created the existing virtual reality program of Apollo 11. So they're going to be tweaking their Apollo 11 into being Apollo 14 and then adding Edgar's original narration of his experience, hoping that people can have this experience when they're in 360 VR in space, looking out the window at the Earth and getting a little nudge from Edgar himself about what he was experiencing.
What a great idea. I don't know if anyone has solved this, but one of the things that has intrigued me is the question of what is it about three dimensions that is so powerful? I've had a lot of experiences. I had an experience similar to walking through a haunted house and seeing this curtain blow, and I actually felt there was breeze on my face, and there was no breeze on my face. Yeah. If I'd seen it in 2D, it wouldn't have worked at all. Do we know anything about how the brain works that makes three dimensions such a game changer?
You know, to be honest, I'm not sure, but I think one of the things that's really fascinating about this is if you think about how involved you get in a movie when you go to see a movie in the theater, that's two-dimensional with sound. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're like me, but I think a lot of people are, where you are in the middle of that story. I mean, you are absolutely focused. It's rare that you kind of step out of the film and have extra thoughts. Imagine when we change that to the entire experience surrounding you with a haptic vest, for example, where mm-hmm. you can have vibrations, with smells, with wind in the air. The truth is that our perceptual system is just very susceptible to illusion, and that can work against us, but it can also work for us. So another thing that we're thinking about doing is using the virtual reality system to work on consciousness and healing. So let's say you have back pain and someone tries with a guided meditation to say, imagine you're a cool waterfall moving through your spine. Now you can go into VR and actually see the cool waterfall moving through your spine, and you can wear a vest that gets cooler in the back. And so we're really trying to, in a way, we're trying to harness what they used to call the placebo effect, which is actually mind-body healing.
I had another thought of this, and I don't know if anyone worked on it. I have scoliosis, and I thought how interesting it would be if I could see my own spine straightening, my own spine, where it's actually, you know, they've taken an X-ray, and they just like seeing yourself older, you know. And if I saw that happening very gradually, would my brain start to pick something up from VR and actually start to straighten the spine?
I love that. That's a great question. That would be a wonderful research question. I mean, I think we all know that the mind has a tremendous effect on the healing of the body, yet there's still some resistance in the scientific and the medical community to actually use these techniques. And the more we can boost the effects of them, make them more robust, perhaps through adding this booster through VR, the more they're going to be used. Mm-hmm. I think there's also, from the noetic sciences side of things, the potential that VR may be able to unlock latent capacities that we don't know that we have. So one of the analogies I like to use is that when they're looking at evolution, sometimes they use Drosophila, which are fruit flies that have very short lifespans. And so one of the experiments was exposing the fruit flies to a very, very cold environment and seeing how many generations would it take for them to adapt to the environment, and it took them many, many less generations than they thought. They started to sprout hair to adapt to the cold environment much faster. That's when they realized that it was actually about gene expression, mm-hmm. not about natural selection. Mm-hmm. And so that ability to have these dormant genes that are turned off that when you're exposed to a particular environment get turned on. What if there are environments in VR that don't have to obey the rules of Newtonian physics that our ordinary reality does, but we can expose people to it for 20 minutes a day or 30 minutes a day? Who knows what kinds of things could be unlocked?
That's a fabulous idea. So at next year's conference, can I come and experience exactly that?
I hope so.
That would be wonderful. Well, Cassandra Vieden, I want to thank you for this wonderful institution, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and for all the passionate and devoted work that you've done for spearheading the conference happening July 18th through 21st, and for coming on Hot Tech Cool Science to talk to us about it. It's been great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You are listening to Hot Tech Cool Science. I'm your host, Julie Motz. We're going to take a music break, and then I'll be back with our last guest.
Des yeux qui font baiser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur, une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi.
Ah, yes, La Vie en Rose, Life Seen Through Rosy Glasses. And that's not Edith Piaf. It's a wonderful singer whose name I'll have to get off the CD, who does a wonderful Edith Piaf rendition. So we're now going to be talking with Ari Inbar. He's the founder of the first early stage fund dedicated to augmented reality. And you might say that augmented realities, it's not looking through at life through rose-tinted glasses, but through very specially designed glasses to enhance your view of life. He's also the co-founder and CEO of Augmented Reality ORG, a global not-for-profit organization devoted to advancing augmented reality, and it produces AWE, the most essential AR and VR conference. It's been happening since 2010. It's happening May 29th through 31st in Santa Clara. So welcome back, Ori. I think we had you on last year to talk about the conference.
Yes. Hi, Julie. Awesome to be back.
Yeah. So what got you interested? You know, although, you know, to those of us immersed and passionate, it feels like AR is everywhere. Everybody must know about it. But actually, still a relatively small portion of the population. What you got you interested and got you interested so early?
Yeah, I got into it 12 years ago when I felt like my kids are always stuck in front of the screen. And we need to find a way to get them to interact with the real world. And I thought, we're not going to be able to reverse what they're doing, but maybe there's a way to use some of the spatial computing techniques to get kids and adults to interact with the real world and really be more aware of it.
And what do you mean by spatial computing specifically?
So, for the past 50 years, computing has been a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional world. And when you think about it, it's not really natural. It's not how our brains are wired. We are used for the past million years to interact with in space, with people, with things, with places. And computing hasn't been doing this for us. So spatial computing actually allows us to move in space, to interact in space, just like we do with the usual world.
So the idea to get your kids back to the real world was to make the screen world more like the real world.
In a sense, taking the good things about computing and the exciting things about computing and bring it into the real world. Mm-hmm. So kind of combining the two was the purpose.
And where was AR back in 2010, and where has it come to now?
So actually, up until 2010, augmented reality was mostly hidden in labs around the world in the research domain. But then a few things happened. First, the iPhone and Android phones emerged, and they became a great platform to experience AR. And then tech giants started to invest in different AR technologies, and the industry was born. So in 2010, you know, we were still very small. We had, you know, 300 people in a room talking about ideas and concepts. And that has changed dramatically until today, where you see thousands of people across the entire industry with hundreds of exhibitors showcasing real products, hardware, software, different development tools, applications in practically any vertical you can think of. So it has really gone a long way since then.
Well, what did you expect in your wildest fantasy back in 2010? What did you expect to see in AR that has happened? And what were you hoping to see that hasn't happened yet?
So I was very impatient. I have to say that I was sure that we will all wear smart glasses a few years back. But it obviously took much longer than that. But the good news is that we anticipated, well, we kind of set a sort of a moonshot back then to achieve 1 billion users of AR by the end of the decade, as in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you look at the use of mobile AR today, according to Facebook, over a billion people have tried it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're actually pretty close to that goal, maybe even ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Deadline.
And what role did Pokemon Go have in that?
It had a huge role, I think. Although, you know, for most of us hardcore industry guys, it wasn't the true AR that we were expecting.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of educated the masses about the idea of engaging in gaming and entertainment in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to go out there and, you know, find them and interact with people out there. And that was a big change from the gaming that we've seen until that point. So, although, again, it didn't have the most advanced technology, it definitely advanced the topic of AR and helped introduce it to the mainstream.
You know, I just listened to an interview on NPR about an artist who has paintings and murals that are going up all around San Francisco, but with an AR application on your phone. So if you look at them, you'll actually find the history of the person, you know, being painted. Do you think it's going to reach a point where that's going to be just the norm and people are going to feel, you know, that anything historical they look at, they should be able to find an AR, you know, overlay on their phones? I mean, how quickly is that happening?
Actually, I think it's happening faster than we think. First, the company that developed Pokemon Go, Niantic Labs, is now introducing new games that are actually really understand the entire world and can really map cities and buildings and overlay it with persistent augmented reality content. So in that game, anywhere you go, you basically see AR content out there. So I think, you know, as long as it's on smartphones, you still have to pull your phone from your pocket and look out there and see it. So it's a bit of a barrier. Once we're transitioning to smart glasses, which, you know, it's probably still a few years away until the mainstream adopts it in large numbers, at that point, it will be always on AR, and then, you know, anywhere you go, anywhere you look, you get immediate information, whether it's for entertainment or for informational and utility purposes.
Well, you know, I did mention the AWE conference coming up May 29th through 31st, AWE 2019. If you want to register, you can find that very easily on the internet. I know it covers, you know, entertainment industry. What in particular are you excited about seeing there? And I know it's like asking someone to choose among children for a favorite, but I'm going to ask anyway.
That's exactly right. I mean, for me, they're all amazing. There's, you know, over 300 speakers that are going to give talks across the entire spectrum for, you know, for enterprises, for designers, for developers, for marketing, for healthcare, and so on and so forth. So really fantastic talks across 6 tracks running through the 3 days of the event. There'll be over 230 exhibitors in the exhibit hall from, you know, large companies that are displaying their new products to fresh new startups that are showcasing either new tools or new techniques or some applications. So it's going to be really exciting just to walk through the hall and discovering all these things, because there's no other place on Earth where you can see such a density of AR and VR experiences.
Okay.
But one thing that will be maybe really interesting for everybody listening is the playground, which is a complete experiential area dedicated to AR and VR. Nobody's tried to sell you anything. It's just really to experience how our lives are going to change with AR and VR.
I have to tell you what my best experience at last year's conference was. It was learning how to salsa dance. There was an application where you could learn how to salsa dance, and then afterwards you could go in the next room and actually dance with a real salsa dancer. And I think I learned in 5 minutes. It was extraordinary. So I'm curious, in terms of hardware, the technology, what is the most interesting to you at this point? What are the latest developments?
So I think, you know, when it comes to mobile AR, it's just your regular smartphone, and there's no, you know, much news there, at least not until we hear from Apple later this year.
What's Apple going to be bringing us, do you think?
Well, I mean, there are rumors that the new iPhone will actually have some advanced or enhanced AR capabilities, which will transform the ability to use it for AR. I mean, today it's already a good enough device for mobile AR experiences, but it may get even better.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the innovation on hardware is happening, first of all, with smart glasses. We'll have the show, dozens of companies showcasing new smart glasses. Some of them are targeting enterprises, so, you know, they may be big and ugly, but functional. And also some new ones for consumers. So for the first time, we'll see devices that people could wear, you know, on a day-to-day basis and not look too awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And even in a, you know, normal price point, so mm-hmm. not to break your pocket. But then there's also some new interaction devices because, you know, in AR, in spatial computing, there's no keyboard and mouse. So how do you interact with the computing layer? So there's, you know, anything from gloves to suits to gesture techniques that are really trying to push the envelope of what it means to interact when there's no keyboard and mouse.
Mm-hmm. So that's the technology. What in terms of content that's new have you seen that really excites you?
So again, content is going to span practically any aspect of life. There's a lot of really interesting solutions for big corporations. There's a lot of new things around advertising because we believe that this could be a great form to get more people into AR through augmented reality advertising. There's, you know, plenty of entertainment and social and kind of new types of interaction techniques on smartphones. And then, you know, healthcare and training, construction, practically any aspect of life you can think of will be covered in some form at this mm-hmm. event. And also there's a special focus on societal impact.
Mm-hmm.
So applications that really try to help humanity.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see a bunch of those as well.
I know Vive has a whole Vive for Impact initiative. They're doing mostly, I think they're primarily focused on climate change. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what other people are doing. Well, I'm also looking forward to, and I don't think, where medical VR is far enough along where people are doing serious research saying, you know, we used, you know, AR in this surgery and it went that much faster. We had that, you know, that less blood loss, whatever. You know, I would be really excited when it's established enough that that kind of hard data can start to come forward, because I know the medical profession is slow to change and it would be terrific to have those kinds of studies coming forth. Do you know of anybody thinking about that right now?
That's exactly right. I mean, if you look at the adoption of AR and VR in the healthcare industry, it's in varying degrees. In some cases, like training, it's already happening today, whether it's using anything from tablets to simulate how do you treat a dummy that actually looks like a real person and behave like a real person, to using, you know, VR training to teach healthcare providers how to assist others before they need to deal with the real people. There's also the remote expert assistance idea, which is helping remote medical providers to get expertise from people that may not be able to be on site through smartphones. So kind of like a remote or teleportation customer support for those on site. So it's really kind of in various degrees. And then when it comes to the operating room, it's so far it's mostly been in experimentation mode. Mm-hmm. The ability to take MRIs and X-rays and overlay it on real people, for example, in a way that makes the surgery more accurate.
And unlikely that you'll be operating on the left leg when the right leg needs it, right?
Exactly. But that's why, but because this industry is slow to adopt these new technologies because, you know, it's about life and death. It's a bit still in the pilot mode before it gets into, real operational.
Well, Ori Inbar, I want to thank you for being such a pioneer in this area. I mean, I only fell into AR and VR like 3 years ago and became delighted. But without people like you, there wouldn't have been this whole field for me to fall into. So I want to thank you for that and for having these extraordinary conferences every year. Once again, it's the AWE Conference, May 29th to 31st in Santa Clara. Just Google AWE 2019 and you'll see this incredible array of events and experiences. And thank you so much for coming on Hot Tech Cool Science again to talk to us about it. It's been great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much and looking forward to seeing you all.
Yeah. It's Hot Tech Cool Science. Please stay tuned for Classical Thursday with Annika van der Veen. I won't be here next week. I'll be at the AWE conference. But the week after that, I'll be back with Arts Desire. We're going to be talking to Carrie Pilto, who was on many years ago with the Steins Collect exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. She's edited an extraordinary book about a very little known art collector who was a friend of Matisse and Picasso and many other people. And it's about his works and his life. It's a gorgeous book. And I think you'll really have a good time listening to Carrie talk about it.